I'm in downtown Sydney, in the heart of the Central Business District. It's all skyscrapers and bitumen, the roar of inner city traffic. In this context, it's hard to imagine, but 2.25 centuries ago, none of this was here. It was a vastly different landscape, defined by ridgelines and gullies covered in native bushland. And flowing through it all, a freshwater stream, the water source that Australia was built around. You're listening to Off Track on RN with me, Joel Werner, and I'm heading underground to see what remains of that original water supply. Today, I'm exploring the tank stream.
Tours started in 1988, which is the bicentennial year, and it was started partly due to the generosity of Sydney Water, but also Lend Lease, because the meeting room that we meet in is three parking spaces from the Lend Lease car park, which over that many years is a worthy donation.
So there's three disgruntled Lend Lease businessmen out there bemoaning the existence of the tank stream. Yeah,
that's right. And the cost turned out to be a little bit more than thought as well. It was duly opened, but the first flood after that, the manhole cover where people entered flowed over and the whole room was flooded with stormwater. And so therefore that particular manhole had to be converted into something akin to a submarine's hatch cover, so that it gets bolted down at the end of each day now. So it shows that doing the right thing, you can have to spend more money along the way as well.
So the tank stream is still quite an active beast then. It still floods and it still carries water. Water still flows through it.
Obviously, you've got to keep an eye on things that, say, a water main might break up the other end of town, and then you'd get a flush going down. From time to time, the pumps and the basements of the multi-storey buildings decide to cut in at a particular time, and as a result, you get an increase in flow. It's not a live sewer these days. It was a part sewer up till around about 1970, but one of the jobs Sydney Water has done over the years is separate the sewer and the stormwater, and that's important because now with sewage treatment at large plants like Bondi, it's much more efficient if you only treat the sewage and not have to have it diluted with stormwater as well.
Farewell to old England forever. Farewell to me old pals as well. Farewell to the well-known Old Bailey, where I once used to cut such a swell. Singing to Rely, Rely at a tea.
John Breen is a heritage engineer with Sydney Water, and he leads the tank stream tours. What's left of the stream runs right underneath the Sydney CBD at the very heart of the city.
That area around there is interesting because when you look in the back of a street directory, you think Sydney must have been a bit drunk at the time it was all laid out. But that was because the streets then were either parallel to or at right angles to the water's edge, and with the water's edge coming right up to Bridge Street to put a whole different pattern. So now you get the two patterns on top of each other, the normal grid pattern like Adelaide and the triangular pattern like early Sydney.
I mean, it could be said that at the time the colony was being developed, there was quite a lot of drinking involved anyway. I think rum was a currency for a time, so, I mean, that could play into it. But the tank stream, it's amazing to think that this area of Australia is perhaps one of the most iconic places in the country these days. But the reason Philip chose to colonise there was largely to do with this fresh water supply, which was the tank stream.
Indeed, and it wasn't meant to happen, because as the song goes, we were bound for Botany Bay. But having arrived at Botany Bay on the 20th of January, they realised it was no show for water. So they actually had to send boats out to go searching, because Sydney Harbour hadn't been entered by Captain Cook. And in looking around, within 6 days, they decided that Sydney was the place and the tank stream would be the water supply, because it had a nice, fresh flow of water.
When you go on the tank stream tour, you don't just open a hatch and jump straight into the stream. First off, you head to the meeting room, the former Lend-Lease car park, where you get kitted out with a full body harness, gum boots, a hard hat and headlight.
All right, let's start with you. Yeah. before I introduce you to John, who's going to take you down to the tank screen today, we're just going to show you a short video which is going to give you a nice brief intro into the tank stream and the history of Sydney.
Captain Phillips' party explored Port Jackson in open longboats for 2 days. They'd rejected Botany Bay as unsuitable. They were looking for a deep, sheltered cove for their settlement, and it had to have water.
It's a long time and a very long time to me, why, hi, how. It's a long time and a very long time.
The initiation video is a bit naff. It's all 90s VHS production values and casting extras in colonial costume. But it does act as a decent primer for the historical significance of the stream we're about to visit.
My mother, she did tell to me, it's a long time.
Philip no doubt believed that streams in the new land would flow all the year round, as they did at home. He wrote that he picked Sydney Cove because it had the finest spring of water. Soon discovered that the water seeped from a swamp less than a mile upstream on the western side of today's Hyde Park. It was also fed by two or three small springs. Spring Street was named after one. But it only flowed strongly after rain. And it dried up quickly. Wind north-northwest. It felt like the blast of a heated oven. The sky hazy. The sun gleaming through at intervals. Our dogs, pigs and fowls lay panting in the shade. 3 dry summers in a row reduced the stream to a trickle. Governor Phillip had convict gangs gouge out 3 tanks from the sandstone beside the stream.
The only way you can overcome a drought is to build storages, that is, reservoirs. So they hit upon building tanks and thereby gave it a name as well. The plan was to build 4 tanks, 2 on each side of the stream. They only ever built 3 because the eastern side gets favour, because with the spring up Spring Street, that one tank got plenty of water from Spring Street, whether the other side had to take its chances. And having built the tanks didn't necessarily overcome all the problem as well, because when you do have a minor flood, if any rubbish is left in the stream, it gets washed down into the tanks, so your tanks can be polluted. Even after a flood.
Pollution was the bugbear of the tank stream throughout its history. In his unauthorised biography of Sydney, Leviathan, John Birmingham traces the demise of the tank stream in spite of successive governors' attempts to protect it.
The settlers tried to augment their precarious water supply even as they so efficiently destroyed it. Philip had a paling fence erected alongside the stream to prevent hungry stock from eating the shrubs on the banks and befouling the water. He then had deep tanks cut into the sandstone to catch and hold thousands of litres of water as insurance against the droughts and baffling tricks of the local weather. These engineering works, which gave the tank stream its name, sufficed for a time. But they filled with silt and sand as erosion denuded the parched and exposed landscape beyond the paling fence. When Philip left the colony at the end of 1792, you could say that all of the New South Wales Corps' Christmases were about to come at once. With no real check on their power or appetites, the Corps was pretty much free to do as it pleased. And it pleased more than a few of them to build their homes on the verdant slopes of the Tank Stream, to catch the breezes and views, and give their livestock easy access to water and food. Hungry pigs and goats quickly broke through those fences which hadn't been torn down by their owners, stripped the banks of foliage, and polluted the town's water supply with their prodigious output of feces and urine. The occupants of those picturesque little cottages threw their offal and excrement directly into the streets, where it sat and baked in the sun until washed into the tank stream by a downpour.
From here on, successive governors attempted to protect the stream. Dire warnings were issued. Convicts were flogged. Settlers were fined and threatened with the tearing down of their houses. But as the settlement became a town, the pollution grew worse. Slaughterhouses and tanneries drained into the stream. The colony's priority was to supply Britain with rural produce. There was less urgency about living conditions for the people of Sydney. The tank stream was slowly choking. In 1826, it was abandoned as Sydney's water supply, and it would be 11 years before a second supply was completed. But the town now had an open sewer running right through its centre. By the 1850s, the death rate from fever was alarming. The stream had to be covered.
From being a freshwater creek to being the tank stream that we know today, and an underground series of tunnels completely buried. How did the tank stream get buried beneath the city? What was the process of covering it up?
Yeah. We're lucky we have an 1857 photograph of it before the covering went on. It just looks like an open stream. The covering went on really to hide the smell in the tank stream. And in some ways that became a problem, because the only way you could do a roof of any size is with an arch, in those days a sandstone arch. But the trouble with an arch is, as you get higher up the arch, you get less and less flow width, and so therefore you greatly restrict the flow once you put the arch on. They partly overcame that by reorganising, and part of the catchment went to different places. Part went to Darling Harbour, part went to Woolloomooloo Bay, Blackwattle Bay. So the tank stream only became a sort of a lesser thing, collecting probably only half the catchment that it normally did. One of the things that does span the tank stream to the present day is, in fact, the Sydney Cenotaph. That was built by Dr. J.J.C. Bradfield, who, in addition to that, did the City Railway and the Sydney Harbour Bridge. He was such a patriotic citizen that he picked the largest block of granite from the Maruya Quarry and brought it up to Sydney, and it spans the tank stream and is the Sydney Cenotaph. Rocks like granite you can get to span some distance, but sandstone doesn't have those sort of properties.
In 1860, a section from Hunter to Bridge Street was covered with an arched stone ceiling. 6 years later, a sandstone block canal was laid from King to Hunter Street, and a section downstream from Martin Place was covered over. From this time on, the channel was roofed not with stone arches, but with brick, creating an overform or egg-shaped tunnel. The design helped the passage to be self-cleaning and gave it greater structural strength to support the growing city above. The building of the GPO in Martin Place in the 1870s caused the remaining part of the upper tank stream to be covered over. But though the stream was being buried, it was still very much alive, flooding basements during downpours, undermining foundations, and always discharging its burden into Sydney Cove.
Yeah, so today, going beneath the modern city, walking on some of the contours and rocks of the original tank stream, Sydney's first water supplier and the feature that defined the layout and location of the city of Sydney. Today on the tour, we have John Bream at the bottom of the stairs. John was an engineer with Sydney Water for almost 40 years. His later years, he also became Sydney Water's archivist. He worked at Warragamba Dam, the Up and the PN Scheme, and Heritage Stormwaters. He is a member of the Institution of Engineers Heritage Committee and the National Trust Industrial Heritage Committee. He also leads tours along the route of Busby's Bore, the water supply that replaced the tank stream, and he's a member of the Sydney Water Heritage Committee. And we also have Yvonne Kaiserglass, who's an archaeologist with Sydney Water. When you head down to the tank stream, if you can just stay close to John and Yvonne so that you can hear what's being said, you will do a loop, so there's no need to move around too much, just follow the leader. And if you can not talk too much, there's might be a little bit of echoing. And there's also some hand gel if you wanted to use it before and after you go down, you're more than welcome to. So with your torches on your helmets, if you just turn them to the red, and if anyone needs me to tighten their helmets for them, just let me know. So if you want to line up and head down down for tank training, I can take photos for anyone if you like as well.
These days we insist on people being kitted up properly, which is helmets and boots, but also harnesses so that they can be lowered down. Even though it's only about a 1.5-metre drop, people have to be kitted up for that.
So this is where that harness comes into play. You get hooked into a carabiner that's connected to a safety wire and hop down a steel ladder. Suddenly, you're underground in a concrete drain, and the water that trickles by at ankle height, that's the tank stream.
And getting them down one at a time through the manhole, we get them to go down and assemble, and then as a group, when they're all down, we're at a point where the concrete, which was only put there about 40 years ago, meets the sandstone arch, and that's where it's a really stark difference. And we can point out that the flat roof is by courtesy of reinforced concrete, which can give you a flat roof, whereas a sandstone arch is very much on the arch. So we tell them that by just stepping over the line, we're really jumping back over 100 years.
Yeah, this represents really stepping back in time, because it's over 100 years to step from the reinforced concrete part here to the stone part. But so that's why this is such an important part. The stone arch is probably what you've come for, because that's what gets on all the brochures, and that's very important. But the stone arch only went here 80 years after the floor was done. The floor is the important part to this, because the floor was the part that had to be clean so that water could get into the tanks, which were about 50 metres downstream. So that was a really important part. But also, an arch has a disadvantage, although it looks nice, that as your flood level rises, as you get higher and higher, you keep running out of width. And so that's one of the advantages of reinforced concrete that you're standing under now. The other point that's important is...
But even the sandstone arch, people think it must be convict, and it does tend to look that way in photographs, but it was only done in 1857, which is after convict transportation finished. So we point out that the initials in the sandstone blocks are put there for the stonemasons so that they could be paid at the end of their day. And then we proceed to walk up the stream. We tell people to look at the floor in particular. In fact, the floor is the most important part of it, because the floor is the part that is convict done. And to make it healthier in the early days, the way they did it was to try and get a flat floor. And that was done by knocking the high points off, but at the same time putting sandstone flags over the low points. And part of the maintenance of the stream is to make sure that those sandstone flags don't wash off, because you don't mind losing one sandstone block in a flood. But the trouble is, in losing one, you might lose 50, and therefore you really can't put them back where they were. We then point out to them that as they go further up, they're able to actually start standing, the average person.
Now, I can not stand up here. That's important because a little bit further on, I'm able to stand up. There is a particular reason for that.
We soon come to a cast iron aqueduct which runs at right angles to the stream. That's part of the Bennelong sewer, and we point out that that's made of lots of cast iron smaller parts all bolted together. It's bolted together top and bottom and left and right, because in those days large castings couldn't be made in Sydney, but a foundry down in Daly Street about half a kilometre downstream is where Peter Nicol Russell made all that equipment and was able to do a three-span aqueduct at Hunter Street and another one at King Street. But we point out that with the water having to get down and squeeze under that aqueduct, it gains pressure, and as it gets out, it expands. And the reason for the higher roof immediately downstream is to take care of the energy, because too much energy means you get sloshing about and all that sort of thing, and which actually reduces your flow. We really only came across that so-called expansion chamber when we were looking at the plans to prepare it for the State Heritage Register, and we sort of wondered why the thing sort of bobs up at a particular point, and then after about 30 metres it's back to normal again. It's amazing how much technology they had, even in those early days.
You're listening to Off Track on RN, and today we're underneath the Sydney CBD, exploring the tank stream. I'm Joel Werner.
Where does the manhole cover come out?
About traffic line number 2 in Hunter Street.
All right. So we won't poke our heads out of there then.
I can't swear to the witch's hats are up there, but I've been told that they're up there because I've been here all morning. You do remind me that at Busby's Boar in Oxford Street, when Busby's Boar was put there, trams weren't around, but in the meantime, trams got laid, and so therefore, if you popped your head up from the manhole, you could well have a tram coming at you. So they laid pipes to the side of the road so you can get in at the side, which was a blessing at the time. And then to come up here in a single line, that way you each get a chance to look up the OB form. The OB form's important because
the end point's where we go into, or would go into, a smaller sewer, a so-called oviform or egg-shaped sewer, with the pointy end downwards. That's considerably smaller than the sandstone arch, and about 20 years later, that was put there to further cover the stream. And to keep it stable, it was made of brickwork, and the oviform are the same shape as the sewers of London, where you have the point at the bottom, and that causes greater flow velocity at the bottom, which tends to keep it clean or self-cleansing, and then you get the arch at the top. We particularly ask people to look at the mortar between the bricks, because that's important, because sewer gases over time can get out and actually start to erode the mortar around the brickwork, and you can have bricks falling out of the roof, which is a problem anyhow, but furthermore, it can actually weaken the arch, and without proper maintenance, an oviform sewer could fall in over time.
Because of this cement mortar here, you can't see the bricks, but these bricks are not your common garden house bricks. These are tapered bricks, specially cork made, and that minimises the amount of cement mortar between the bricks, which is important because sewer gases act on cement, and you can have bricks drop out of the roof, which is a problem if you're under it, but even more of a problem in the longer term, if your central bricks and the roof fall out, you can break your arch and cause a full-scale collapse. But you see a very clear example of this in a saw-cut version up in the old GPO underneath the clock tower, which is now the Western Hotel. So I'll get you to start looking up that. So I'll start to move out and let you...
But over the years of the present century, the stream has reappeared from time to time among the excavations of the new city. Here, the stream has again been diverted. It's been picked up, boxed in concrete, and channeled around and through the new office towers, along the walls of basements, across the ceilings of underground car parks.
With the tank stream ruined, there was no other source of fresh water until 1859. Indeed, the city's enormous thirst was not properly quenched until well into the 20th century, with the construction of dams on the Upper Nepean. Until then, the city's water supply was erratic at best and non-existent at worst.
Another passage from John Birmingham's Leviathan, rounding out our exploration of Sydney's original water supply, the tank stream. If you'd like to go on a tank stream tour, good luck. Places on the tour are assigned according to a ballot, and every year there's about 3,000 applications for 300 spots. If you'd like to try your luck or see some images from the tour, just head to the Off Track website. Go to abc.net.au/radionational and search for Off Track. But that's all there is for this week. Until next time, bye for now.